Shattering Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 110. As I said in the last episode, we are getting to the end of our time in Minsk. And certainly we have to cover the last little bit of work and activity that Oswald undertook to leave the country. But before we do that, we are going on a little Oswald wander. And we're going to talk about something that may be lingering for you as much as it is for me. It's the reason for today's wander, of course. One of the hardest things to believe is that the KGB was not that interested in interrogating Oswald and learning much about what he might have known as a result of being stationed at Atsugi, where the U-2 was. It seemed illogical that they would not want to know, at least know what Oswald was exposed to. Yet the Russians maintained that the KGB did not debrief Oswald on such matters. I don't think it would surprise anybody if the true answer was revealed to be that someone or some agency did, in fact, interrogate Oswald on all of that. And they have just been lying about it all these years, or at least not telling the whole truth. But nevertheless, we are not certain about any of this, as the Soviet intelligence services are as arcane as ours. For this reason, it's worth spending a moment on how the KGB operates within the Soviet system. You see, in this country, we have a very distinct understanding between the jurisdiction of the FBI and the CIA. But in the Soviet Union, the KGB has many functions. But you see, the primary function is one of internal security. Keeping tabs on everyday Russians and understanding what is happening with the proletariat. Searching and finding those elements internally within Russia that are problematic for the Soviet state. A watchdog for every aspect of internal dissension. And that function is very different from the actions which might be taken to seek and interrogate a spy. What we do know is that the KGB didn't dedicate a great deal of its overall resources to foreign intelligence in that era. It was over 30 years later, but in 1991, the KGB was reorganized and certain facts about the KGB came to light at that time. It has been estimated that at that time, only about 12,000 of the employed KGB workforce was focused on foreign intelligence, with the remainder, which was estimated to be as high as 700,000 employees, was focused on domestic surveillance and intelligence and internal dissent. What that means is that less than 2% of the KGB's overall resources would have been focused on reviewing a foreign intelligence matter like the one that Oswald presented. It just wasn't their thing. But honestly, it was somebody's thing, and that thing was left to another element of the Soviet government. The things that Oswald might have been able to relay would have been of great interest to a Soviet military enterprise known as the GRU. It's part of the Soviet Defense Ministry, and GRU is short for a Russian name which I won't even try to pronounce. Some researchers quote that the size of the GRU is larger than the entire intelligence community of the United States Armed Forces. The GRU would very much have liked to have talked to Oswald, and they, unlike the KGB, have never revealed whether Oswald was interrogated or not. Quite a contrast to the KGB assertions that they did not, in fact, debrief Oswald. Sure, it is possible, given the bureaucratic nature of the KGB, that Oswald was not referred to the GRU, and that he got lost in the bureaucracy of the KGB. The KGB was compartmentalized, and it wasn't necessarily the machine that people envision from the propaganda we have been fed. But, well, in reality, unlikely that Oswald was not referred to the GRU. You see, in the Soviet Union, Oswald was big news to the upper echelon of Soviet authority. After all, how often does a U.S. Marine defect to the Soviet Union and then slit his wrists to try and stay in the country? There is no doubt that this question will linger, the question of whether he was reviewed by one of the other intelligence agencies. There is basic evidence that points to the fact that he likely was. But isn't it so convenient that the KGB can so keenly state that they never debriefed him, despite their constant surveillance of him? Maybe they were telling the truth, just not the whole truth. So help them, God. Well, someday, if the GRU was involved, maybe it will come out. We are all patiently waiting. But in this short episode today, for a little more detail on this topic, we're going to pivot and quote directly from a section contained in Russia.org, which covers Oswald in Russia. In 1959, when Oswald arrived in the USSR, the KGB, Committee for State Security, was in its heyday. It had been first known as the Chika, then the OGPU, then the GPU, then the NKVD, then MVD, and MGB, all not necessarily in that order, before it became the KGB in 1954. Its main function had been the suppression of threats within the borders of the USSR. It is estimated that some 20 to 60 million Soviet citizens were put to death between 1918 and 1953 by the secret police apparatus. That is a startling number. When the KGB came into contact with Lee Harvey Oswald, it was divided into several chief directorates. The first chief directorate was responsible for the KGB's foreign operations, including intelligence gathering. The first directorate was almost as separate from the KGB as the CIA is from the FBI. In fact, the KGB's foreign intelligence service was even headquartered away from the infamous Lubyanka complex and based in Yasenevo in the southwest district of Moscow. First Directorate KGB officers looked down on their internal security fellow employees and often attempted to disassociate themselves from their excesses. The larger, more powerful division of the KGB was the Second Chief Directorate, Counterintelligence and Internal Security. Evaluating Oswald as he popped up in the in-tourist hotel system would have been in the jealously guarded jurisdiction of the KGB's Second Directorate. Thus, in assessing Oswald, the KGB would first have been concerned as to whether he was a threat to the Soviet Union by his presence there. His potential value as an agent or as a source of intelligence was of absolutely no interest to the Second Directorate field officers evaluating Oswald. Imagine an FBI agent while interviewing a suspected Russian agent concerning himself with the possibility of turning that individual and sending him back to Russia, or attempting to extract intelligence on Russian troop strength or chain of command. It is not what the FBI does. That was likewise for the KGB Second Directorate in 1959. Necheparenko does state in his book Passport to Assassination that the first directorate had a Department 15 responsible for the recruitment of foreign visitors to the USSR as Soviet agents. However, it relied on information forwarded from the second directorate and did not have an operational presence inside the tourist system. Why, might you ask? Well, because the second directorate was trying to take that function on itself and would do so successfully. In later years, Department 15 was disbanded and its functions transferred to the Second Directorate. Furthermore, at first glance, Oswald was not an ideal candidate for recruitment as an agent anyway. He had openly journeyed to the USSR, thus making himself visible to U.S. security. He was a low-ranking Marine, no longer on active duty, and he had no access to classified material. He was uneducated and held no promise of future access to information or influence. At closer scrutiny, the Russians would have noted his youth, immaturity, and unconventional and erratic behavior. He would have been judged too unreliable as a potential agent. All that is assuming that the first directorate, Department 15, had even learned of his presence. Once Oswald staged his suicide and then attempted to renounce his citizenship at the U.S. Embassy, any lingering and remote considerations for his use as a Soviet agent would have vanished forever. It was the second directorate which jealously guarded its operational zone in the Interest Hotel system. It was they who were dealing directly with the problem of Oswald. But the second directorate was not concerned with gathering intelligence, only with assessing Oswald's presence as a potential danger to the USSR. Any idea of recruiting Oswald or even extracting intelligence out of him would not have been the concern of the KGB officers evaluating Oswald. Perhaps a young, zealous, and highly motivated counterintelligence officer, upon encountering Oswald, would have phoned around or cabled another branch of the KGB, informing them of his existence. But such individuals are scarce in any bureaucracy, Soviet or other. At the end of the day, the KGB officer handling Oswald decided to go home for the night rather than risk putting in more work without overtime. We know that the KGB official who initially met with Oswald on October 20th to assess his request for asylum in the USSR was a veteran secret police officer who had joined the service in the 1920s. His name was Abram Shaknazarov. After having participated in and survived 3 decades of Stalinist shot-to-the-nape-of-the-neck policing, Shaknazarov was very close to his pension. The KGB's recommendation that Oswald be put on the next train out of the country was a safe recommendation that any long-careered intelligence bureaucrat could feel secure in. History shows that the KGB's first directorate, Department 15's function of recruiting agents among the tourists and visitors, was eventually transferred to the second directorate. There obviously was a clash between the two directorates over operations inside the territory of the USSR, almost akin to the highly defined division between the CIA and the FBI jurisdictions. It is possible that interdepartmental politics even led to the second directorate deliberately keeping the first in the dark as to the existence of Oswald and his potential intelligence yield. In any case, the moment it became clear that Oswald was not leaving the USSR, he was drawn, inescapably, into the second directorate's orbit, whose only concern was that Oswald not pose a threat inside the USSR. The GRU would have been interested in questioning Oswald on anything he might have learned in his U.S. Marine Corps tour of duty, but the GRU was very far removed from the Interest Hotel system. U.S. military personnel were not staying in Moscow's hotels in any abundance. Again, the GRU would have depended upon a call from the Second Directorate to learn of Oswald's presence. This is unlikely, as the KGB had always maintained a hungry eye on the GRU and had attempted a takeover several times previously. The two agencies cooperated no more than was necessary. In the end, when in 1962 it was discovered that a senior GRU officer, Oleg Penkovsky, was a spy run jointly by the US-UK, the KGB made its move, securing the right to approve the appointment of the GRU command. Niche Perenko reports that an unknown Russian intelligence officer interviewed Oswald on November 4th and that he was not from the Second Directorate. It is very likely that this was somebody from the first directorate, or perhaps from the GRU, taking a look for themselves as to what Oswald was about. They were not impressed because Oswald angrily pursued a promised further meeting, only to discover that nobody existed under the name that was given him. Oswald also notes testily in his diary that he is called to a meeting with 3 officials in late November, and they appear to ask him questions as if they knew nothing of his case. In 1959, the KGB was all geared up for extracting intelligence from U.S. targets abroad, but not from targets inside its own backyard. When Oswald arrived in Russia, there was no highly developed tourist industry. Foreign business, cultural, and scientific visitors were only starting to arrive in any significant number. Furthermore, Oswald was what is known in the intelligence craft as a walk-in, somebody who makes the first approach. All intelligence agencies regard walk-ins with nothing but the deepest of suspicion. The Russians could have very easily made the deliberate decision not to attempt to debrief Oswald. What would Oswald have yielded had he been spoken to? Not really a big question mark at this point. Perhaps testimony that was right there in the Warren Commission report from one of Oswald's commanding officers tells the true story. According to the testimony of his Marine crew commander at El Toro, Lieutenant John Donovan, Oswald had access to the location of all bases in the West Coast areas, all radio frequencies for all squadrons, all tactical call signs, and the relative strength of all squadrons, number and type of aircraft in a squadron, who was the commanding officer, the authentication code of entering and exiting the ADIZ, which stands for the Air Defense Identification Zone, and he also knew the range of our radar. He knew the range of our radios, and he knew the range of surrounding units' radios and radars. There are some things which he knew on which he received instructions that there is no way of changing, such as the MPS-16 height finder radar gear. He had also been schooled on a piece of machinery called a TPX-1, which is used to transfer radio, radar, and radio signals over a great distance. Radar is very susceptible to homing missiles, and this piece of equipment is used to put your radar antenna several miles away and relay the information back to your site, which you hope is relatively safe. He had been schooled on this. The questions linger about all of this, and the intrigue is thick. But before we get into the mechanics of Oswald's final pivot out of the Soviet Union and back to the United States, join us in the next episode, episode 111, when we begin to draw a connection between Oswald, the defector to Soviet Russia, and Yuri Nosenko, the Soviet defector to America. With Nosenko, in a twist of poetic fate, was substantially involved with the Oswald file in Russia. Thank you for listening to episode 110 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.